You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The Gospel of Blood is the autobiography of Nico Clos, a French morgue attendant whose morbid obsessions led him to grave robbery, cannibalism, and murder in the early 1900s. It is a bone-chilling chronicle of a real-life vampire who prowled the Gothic cemeteries of Paris, unearthing coffins and mutilating the bodies inside. A practicing Satanist, Clos escalated to murder after working for a year in several morgues, receiving orders to kill from the corpses he had autopsied. The Gospel of Blood provides a rare insight into a killer's tortured mind, as he relates the graphic details of his crimes, including never-before-revealed confessions. It is a fascinating look inside the thoughts of a psychotic murderer who has found redemption in prison through art. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Gospel of Blood, The Crimes and Trial of the Vampire of Paris, in his own words. Special guest, journalist and author and artist, Nico Clos. Welcome to the program and thank you so much for this interview, Nico Clos.
Good evening, Dad.
Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you.
Now, this Gospel of Blood, tell us first about your early childhood, as you write in the book. Tell us about where you were born, and tell us about your parents and your early family life and what it was characterized by.
I was born in the 70s, in 1972, in Cameroon, in Africa. My father was traveling a lot because of his job as a technician for a bank in France. So he was traveling the world. And I was born in Africa, in Cameroon. We stayed in Cameroon for a year, so I don't have any recollection of the country. What I can recall from vague, you know, from what my mother told me is that it was a very hostile environment for my mother as a young mother. And she couldn't wait to go back to Europe. So we stayed a year in Africa and then we came back to Paris. We spent several years in several other countries. My very early childhood was spent in several different locations. We did not have a stable environment at all. We then settled in Paris in the middle of the 70s. And I had a pretty normal childhood, except that I did not have the best of relationships with my parents, maybe. My father was really cold, emotionally speaking. That is the way that she was raised as a child, too. So there was not much affection on both sides. And my father was often away for his work in several countries. And so I spent my childhood alone. I didn't have many friends at school. It was a very, very lonely childhood, yes.
What, now we were talking about very different interests than most young boys would be interested in. Tell us about the genesis of some of these interests that would be much different than other boys of your age. Tell us where some of these interests derive from.
From a very early age, I was very drawn to stories of African tribes and voodoo and possession rituals. Because my father had all those books at home, he was very interested in ethnology, the study of the different customs of different tribes in Africa. So I was exposed to all that. And he also showed me photographs from his world travels. It was in the 70s, so, of course, as a child, I did not have access to the internet. It was not a thing that existed. So all those information were coming from my dad, who was bringing back photographs from his travels. And I remember specifically one of the series of photographs that he brought back from Thailand. It was pictures that he had taken in what they called the hell parks.
Right.
Those are parks that are filled with statues that represent the Buddhist conception of hell. So it's different statues showing tortures in very graphic ways, much more graphic than what you can see in a traditional Christian depiction of hell.
Right.
They were showing people being mutilated, cut in half, and extreme torture. Of course, you know, those statues look very naive. They're not realistic at all. But as a 6 or 7 years old child, I would watch that, and I was very fascinated by what I was seeing. And the only clear interaction I remember as a young child with my dad was actually watching those photos with him. So this is, you know, when I think back of my dad, those are the earliest childhood memories that I have of him, showing me those pictures. So they definitely had an impact. Yeah.
Yes, you talk about the impact and the influence that those photos first had, but you're only 6 or 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about your parents' marriage, they finally split up. You don't see any emotion towards them, and you don't have any real emotion towards them. You're very distant from your parents.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the other things that influence you, especially when we're talking about your sexual experiences and development, and some of the things that you were viewing, watching, and consuming in terms of popular culture when that occurred.
As a teenager, I was watching a lot of horror movies, much more than other kids. And so it was in the late 80s. I was discovering all those classic horror movies, The Exorcist and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And there was a very, very clear link for me between sexuality and horror. Because the first sexual drive that I had was watching graphic images of torture and murder. So for me, the link was determined by watching those movies. I would not watch your average mainstream horror movie. I was really looking
right.
for more extreme things, underground movies, movies that were pushing the limits, pushing the boundaries. Back in the days, it was VHS tapes, and I would, as a teenager, I would trade those tapes with
Right.
other people. I found their addresses through small ads in specialized magazines, horror magazines, and we would trade tapes of those movies that I could not have access to in my video stores in Paris. So I had access to very violent movies. Back in the days, I started to read a lot of true crime books. In some of those true crime books, there was pictures of crime scenes. And yes, I began to incorporate them in my sexual fantasies. So yes, there was a definite link between violence and sex from an early age.
Now, you write about that a film stood out for you, about schizophrenia, The Shadow Killer. And
yeah.
Just based on the monologue of the serial killer, you felt a strong impression on you and connection to this. Explain why there was a connection to this movie specifically.
This movie was a movie from the 80s that in German is called Angst, which means fear. And it's based on a real story, a real German-Austrian serial killer. And the movie shows the murders, but from his point of view. And it was a first at the time. And the way it was filmed and the way it was narrated, I found this fascinating. Having, you know, it was like being a voyeur and being a peeping Tom and seeing those acts of cruelty and seeing those acts of sadism through his eyes. And this definitely had an impact on me. There's another movie, which is not a horror movie, that really had an impact on me. It's a movie based on the Richard Chase case by William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist. The movie is called Rampage, and it follows the case of Chase, but this time it's from the forensics point of view. They follow his trial, and the question is about his sanity or not. But what really interested me in that movie was actually seeing him drink blood, human blood, and getting, you know, into those blood orgies. The film was largely it was not really realistic. It did not follow the Chase case to the letter, but it was very grandiose. Some of the scenes were really grandiose. I remember a scene when the killer escapes and the police finds him in a lying on an altar in a church covered with blood, and that image really stuck with me.
Now, you talked about this imagery seeing in these horror movies. You gravitate towards Satanism, and as a result, what other movies do you watch in support of this, and what do you actually do in pursuit of this interest in Satanism?
I was not so much influenced by movies when it comes to Satanism. There is a strong tradition of Satanism in Paris. There was a lot of cults that were practicing the worship of the devil, both in medieval times and modern times. And you can still find churches in Paris that have a lot of demons sculpted on them, and that were used for black masses, what we call black masses, which is an inversion of the traditional Catholic mass. So there's a very long history of devil worship in Paris, and it's through books that I became interested in that spirituality. I did not see it as a form of rebellion, like, you know, many kids take Satanism as a final of a way of rebelling against society, against their parents,
right,
against school, etc. No, for me it was more of a spiritual experience. I was definitely drawn to the macabre and drawn to very, very dark feelings, and I found in Satanism a way of feeling okay about them. For me, there was this religion that accepted me and my dark feelings the way I was, without, you know, treating me as a monster. And traditional Satanism, the European version of Satanism, was a place where I felt in harmony with all my feelings and all my urges.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you write, your newfound demon mania explained and legitimized your bloodlust and your pathological sexual sadism.
Totally.
You talk about hearing late 80s talk show Octave Sieber, a Luciferian,
yes,
mage. Tell us about what you learned or what he had to say that reinforced your feelings, and also talk about your interest in cemeteries.
Octave Sieber was a very well-known figure in the occult underworld in the 80s. So he was often on television, on shows talking about Lucifer and Satan. And I really loved the way that he was speaking on TV. Really became interested in the character. And there was also the fact that he often was filmed in graveyards, and graveyards were the place where I felt the best. So, yeah, I really felt a connection with this character back in the days. You have to understand that I spent most of my free time in graveyards when I was a teenager. And I would know them by, like, the back of my hand. And there were several graveyards in Paris where I used to go. So this is where I felt, you know, the best. It's kind of like, you know, Richard Ramirez used to hang out in the local graveyard when he was living in El Paso. So for me, those graveyards, they were like a huge playground for me. Yeah.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. You talked, Nico, about these cemeteries being a playground for you. But at these cemeteries, there was mausoleums. And so what did you do in these cemeteries other than hanging out and absorbing the energy, as you write? But what else did you begin to do?
When I was about 16, 17, I started to look through the windows of those mausoleums. They had, like, you know, windows which were on the ground level, and there were they were pierced on the wall, and they would show me a glimpse of what the crypts looked like down under. So I became attracted to, but I became more or less obsessed with the act of actually getting having access to those crypts. So there were basically there were two levels in those museums. The ground level was like a chapel, a miniature chapel with an altar. And usually behind the altar or next to the altar, there was stairs going down. All those museums were locked by heavy doors with rusty mechanisms. But they were very primitive. The locks were very, very primitive. And I started to study ways of picking them. I studied lock picking for several months, and I tried and I tried and I tried over and over and over again to make them, to, you know, open them. And I managed to open my very first museum in the graveyard, and then I had access to the crypt under. I remember it quite well, the first one, because it was a very, very ancient Art Deco type of crypt, which was probably built in the 1920s. And there was a lot of Russian Orthodox icons on the wall, and the names on the plaques were Russian. There were probably white Russians, Russians who had fled the revolution, the 1917 revolution. And I could tell that nobody had been inside that crypt for decades. There was, you know, dust everywhere. And I felt like an archaeologist, actually, exploring a tomb.
Mm-hmm.
So I maybe sat down there for about 3 or 4 hours, feeling on the energy, and I decided to do it quite often. And I would pick up the locks, and if I could, I would, when I would leave the museums, I would lock them up behind me again. I would always make sure that nobody would see me doing this. And the more I would practice, and the more I became good at it. So I did this for about 2-3 years before I actually opened my first casket. That was when I was 18 or 19. Yeah.
You talk about this fascination and passion, but you also drooled over Polaroid photos taken by serial killers, and then you would read a book about torture killers, and then later you might watch a dissection scenes. And then get aroused. So you write that you were living 24/7. You were feeding upon human suffering. That was your focus.
Yeah, I was totally obsessed by this. And what you have to understand is that it was decades before the internet. If I had access to the internet back then, I would spend my life online looking at, you know, gore pics and. All the things that are so easily available now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the days, I had to order books online, not online, but through, you know, through mail. And I had to trade tapes, VHS tapes. And the things I could not have access to, I did it myself. So I was growing this environment around me and this death-obsessed environment where I was non-stop all day long thinking about death, graves, murder, torture, mutilation, and, you know, it became obsessional, really obsessional, yeah. What you have to understand also is that it was very gradual. It was escalating. Slowly. It was not like I woke up like one day and I decided to do this or that. Just that, you know, one thing led to another. And the more I did different things, the less I felt guilty about them, and I did not care anymore.
You write about that your father had an opportunity to go to New York City, so you went to New York City and you visited cemeteries and sex clubs. Tell us about your visit to New York City, and you write about that this is the first time that you drank blood, and what was your reaction to that?
So when I was in New York City, I was also left alone quite a lot. And as a 17-year-old in New York City, coming from Paris, it was quite an experience. But I managed to find my way, and I found this occult bookstore that was in, I can't remember exactly the name of the street, but the bookstore was called The Magical Child. And it's the first time, actually, that I went into such a bookstore. The owner was a man called Herman, Horrible Herman, who was a publisher, too, of occult books. I think that he published the Necronomicon, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a young girl when I was at this place, and she showed me the city, and she was more or less into the same kind of things that I was. So while my dad was away working, we would spend most of our time together, and she more or less introduced me to hematophilia, which is the sexual practice, sexual blood play. Yeah, that's how to call it. So using blood during sex, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So she showed me ways of doing it with insulin needles, and there's a lot of things that can be done. And this was my very first experience doing that. I tried to bring this back to Paris, this experience, with other girlfriends, but they were horrified by the idea of using needles and scalpel blades and all these things. But later on, I found a girlfriend who was into that kind of foreplay. So it was the occasion to actually do this again. Yeah.
You write about that once you were back in Paris, you were visiting cemeteries in Paris again.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an opportunity once when workers went to lunch.
Yes.
You
there was
took
one
a bag.
Time when
I... Go yeah. ahead. Sorry.
So, I was actually walking in the alleys of the Père Lachaise Cemetery, and I found one of those museums wide open. And obviously, from all the tools that I found lying on the floor, there were people who were actually excavating a tomb, but they had left for lunch. And instead of, locking the door behind them, they had left it open, wide open. And there was bags, trash bags filled with bones. And I just picked them up. And I left the cemetery carrying those two bags. And I even went to the subway with the bags, carrying the bags. And I saw by the horrified look of the people in the subway that one of the bags was pierced, and there was a bone protruding from the bag. So yeah, that gives you an idea of the state of mind that I was in back in the days. I did not care at all what I was doing, and it's totally sheer luck if I got away with doing certain things that I was doing.
You write about that there was the remains of at least four people in those bags.
Yes.
And then you had the idea of stealing urns. Now, what did you do once you did steal these urns with those ashes? What did you begin to do?
I had those urns at home. I would often play with the ashes. By play, I mean, taking the ashes in my hand and playing with it, like if you play with sand, you know. And one day, it was a time when I was starting to work out. So I was taking those protein shakes. And I had this, you know, weird idea of mixing some of the ashes with the shakes. So in my mind, this would give me the strength of the person that was cremated. That was the idea behind this. And so I mixed them and I drank this. It didn't taste good, as you can imagine, but I kept on drinking it. Because for me, it was like a potion of some kind of, you know. And, you know, using the word cannibal did not even come to my mind when doing this. For me, it was just one of those weird things that I was doing. And there were so many things going on in my life and so many boundaries that I had pushed that, you know, it was just a thing among many others. So I didn't give much, you know, attention. It was much later on when I thought back about this that, it was very bizarre, maybe, from an outside perspective. Yeah.
Now, you write that there was nothing that had control over you at this time, but you were in high school still, and you decided to use a mask of sanity because you had already been the monster at school previously, so you decided to not be so outward and obvious in your interest. And you talked about reading about Jeffrey Dahmer, but you also talked about reading or hearing about a Swedish doctor, and you read about and learned about autopsy. What was this first interest in medical school, potentially?
I remember watching a documentary on TV about people who work in the death industry. So there were embalmers, there was pallbearers, many, many different kind of people. And some of the people that were interviewed were people who were working in morgues. At first, I wanted to become an embalmer, so there was this embalmer school. I tried to apply for it, but I couldn't do it for different reasons. And then my one of my grandparents died. I didn't talk about this earlier, but when I was 10, one of my parents and grandparents had died, and I had seen him in the funeral home, and I was very, very intrigued by what was going on around me, and I was fascinated by the atmosphere of the funeral home. And when my other grandparent died, it was in a hospital that time, and I was not so much emotionally affected by what was going on, but I was very drawn to the atmosphere and to the place itself. And I had this idea of actually applying for that kind of job because I thought to myself that this would be the perfect occasion for me to be in contact with the dead people and working in an environment that I appreciated and doing a job that I would actually like doing. So I applied to several morgues, and I got a reply. The first reply I ever got was from a children's hospital. So I spent 2 weeks there at this hospital. It was 2 weeks of evaluation. They wanted to make sure that I was the right person for that kind of job because of you know, since it was a hospital for children, most of the deceased were either stillborns or very, very, very young toddlers. So psychologically speaking, they wanted to make sure that what I would not, you know, be depressed by the job, etc. And then those first two weeks were really great for me because I actually learned the first steps of working in the morgue. I saw my very first autopsies, and I really was, you know, I knew exactly that I wanted to work in that kind of environment, working with the dead. And since being a lonely child, I never had any siblings. Seeing dead children for me had no immediate psychological impact. For me, it was like, you know, seeing all the, you know, all the people. So I did not have that, you know, emotional affection impact. There was no, you know, I didn't feel anything. And I just loved the environment. I loved the job. I loved assisting to those autopsies. But after those 2 weeks, they decided not to keep me for several reasons. One of the reasons was probably because there was an evaluation with a psychologist, and I probably did not answer the questions the way that the psychologist wanted me to answer. So they said no. And several weeks after that, I found another job in another morgue, and I stayed in Admore for over a year.
You write about that the very first time, or one of the times you were at this morgue, you saw the morgue attendant and the interaction with the nurses from, say, maternity. And then you were, once you worked for that trial week, you were told by this attendant, Jackie, about this interaction.
Yeah.
What was this interaction with the nurses and the attendant that you found so interesting?
So I found out that the morgue is the place in the hospital and many hospital where people usually don't like to go. But, for example, say if you want to be alone somewhere in the hospital, this is where the place where you go. So usually morgues in hospitals, and it's the case in Paris, because after that, in my entire career, I think I've worked in more than 13 hospitals in Paris, all in all. In every single hospital where I worked, the morgue was the place where there was, sexual relationships between nurses. And this is the place where everybody wants to be, you know, left alone. And usually there's arrangements with the morgue, you know, people who work there, so that they turn a blind eye to what's going on and, because they know that staff and human resources will never go down to the morgue to see what's taking place there, because they just don't like the place. They it's a no man's land, a morgue, a hospital morgue. Nobody wants to be there. So this is the place you want to go if you want to do something in private. And the interaction that this guy, the morgue guy I was working in, the interaction that he had with his nurses is that he basically had in sexual relationships with several nurses who were working in the hospital, and he would brag a lot about this. At first, I thought he was just bragging about it, and then I saw the actual, you know, things taking place. I understood that, you know, as weird as it seems, there's a very link, strong link between death and sex for people who work in that kind of environment. It's as if they release pressure, more or less, by having a lot of sexual activities. in that kind of places. So you should not, the thing you have to understand is it's not what people call necrophilia, of course. Necrophilia is having sex with the dead, right?
Sure.
I've never actually witnessed necrophilia coming from a person who works in a morgue. But what's going on is that there's, people have sex on autopsy tables. I've seen that and I've done that too. And people, it's an environment where some women and some men like to, have that kind of interaction because it gives them thrills. And, even on coffins or, So, that's a lot in all my years working in morgues.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages from our sponsor. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find? Sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential from Men 50+ about 12 weeks ago. When it became available, I decided to try it because my wife Lisa has been taking Ritual Essential for Women for over a year now, and she is very happy with the result of taking Ritual daily. She feels that it has made a significant difference, and I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources has sold me. They are a superior multivitamin. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients in forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet. No shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping, always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual today. What we didn't mention just before this, we took this break, was that before you left the children's morgue, this job at this hospital, that you were angry. And as a result, you stole something from that morgue. Tell us what you stole from that morgue before you left.
So just before leaving that morgue, I realized that, probably those the reason why they told me that I would not be working in that morgue was it wasn't the real actual reason. I really thought that it was my co-worker who had, told the human resources that I was not good for that job, but he wanted to, make sure that he kept his harem of nurses, more or less. That was, for me, the actual reason. And one thing that I noticed when I worked in that morgue was something very, very unusual. There were about 300, and you can actually see that number on several websites because it was a huge scandal after that. 300 specimens kept in the morgue. And by specimen, I mean human fetus. They were kept in jars with formaldehyde. And it was not, specimens that are kept in museums for the sake of studies or, it was much darker than that. Normally, when women have abortions, the remains are cremated. But for some obscure reason, the pathologist who was working and who was actually leading the lab upstairs, the morgue, wanted to keep all those stillborns and kept them in jars. There were 300, more than 300. And years later, it was a huge scandal because one family found out about this, and they found out that all those specimens, which were supposed to be cremated, were actually kept there without any supervision and without any tracking number. So it was a huge scandal in France. But back then when I was working there, I quickly understood that there was no tracking for any of those specimens. So since there were 300 of them, I decided that they could make without two. So I just kept two of them. I put them in my sports bag that I had over there. And discreetly, I brought them home. So I had those two specimens, human fetuses, in jars that I got from that morgue. And I placed them on my satanic altar in my apartment. Yes, for me, it was a way of actually keeping a trophy, if you will, from working there.
You were working at the occupation that you dreamed of. When was it that you first felt your desire to kill someone, and who did you first contemplate killing, and why?
I developed murder fantasies when I was in a high school. At first, it was very unspecific. I just wanted to bring a knife and stab other classmates. But the thing was that it was getting obsessional. So I ended up actually carrying a knife with me at school. It was way before they had metal detectors at schools. It was way before Columbine. And one day that knife fell from my bag, and I was they kicked me out for a few weeks. But I went to another school in another country in France, because that took place when I was in Portugal. And when I was in France, other murder fantasies developed. This time it was more specific. I wanted to use handguns. After that, when I went to university, I wanted to climb on top of a tower that was there at the university, kind of like Charles Whitman. And I wanted to shoot at the students, so I studied a way of actually having access to the roof and having access to the gun that I needed. Then I went to the army, and those fantasies followed me too. I was fantasizing about, you know, killing other soldiers. I had actually stolen a rifle from the armory because I was working there, and an automatic handgun. So I had those two war weapons at home, and I had other guns. So all this was, you know, lying under my bed. The thing I was lacking was ammunition. So I was always trying to find ways of finding ammo for those guns. And maybe the fact of going to graveyards and, you know, committing those grave robberies, maybe it calmed me down in terms of those murder fantasies, I don't know, and working in the morgue too. But at the same time, I also wanted to murder my coworkers in the morgue. It's always, you know, it's always about, you know, acting revenge on people I was working with and who I thought were a problem. So there was one day where one of the co-workers invited me to his place, and I had this knife, and I had the impulse of stabbing him. But something strange happened. I actually thought about the fact that he too was working in morgue and that he deserved to live because of that.
Right.
So I decided not to kill him, and I got some kind of, you know, godlike feeling from actually having the decision to kill him or not, like kind of like a Roman emperor after a gladiator game. Thumbs up or thumbs down. So it was the exact same feeling. And I felt that sparing him was also gratifying. It was weird, but yeah, that's how I felt at the time. But the murder fantasies were still there. My girlfriend at the time, and I'm talking about when I was about 22,
right.
My girlfriend at the time was a professional dominatrix.
Right.
She would make a living out of contacting clients on a network that was specific to France at the time. It was called Minitel. It was an early version of the internet. You needed a phone and a computer. You would actually have access to small ads using that phone. You would type messages, and people would leave you their phone numbers, and you would call them, etc., etc. So she was looking for people on the forum, clients. And I was studying the way she would approach those clients using that modem. And little by little, I devised a plan for doing it myself so that I would get away with murdering somebody.
Mm-hmm. You, at the same time, we didn't mention, you have bags of blood in your fridge that you will drink sometimes when you're watching a horror movie, squeeze it out like, anyway. And you would also you also decided to eat human meat, and you seasoned it, and you said you concluded that it tasted like some other type of animal when it was cooked. What was that, and tell us a little bit more about some of the things that you're doing around the same time that you're fantasizing and setting into motion plans to kill someone.
So this took place in the second hospital where I worked. It was a Catholic institute. And so this time it was working with the adults. And one of the tasks that I had to do was to help the doctor during the autopsies. So we would help him, you know, do the cuts, the actual incisions. And when he had finished, when all the organs that he needed were removed, he would leave the room, and I was left alone to stitch the corpses up. And I had access to different, you know, bits and pieces of human meat from the abdomen and the sternum, since we were doing this incision. And instead of throwing them in the bin, at first I started to swallow them raw, because I had this, you know, asphyxiation with blood, human blood. I always made sure that the medical files indicated that that person had no disease, specific disease that could be caught that way, like hepatitis or things like that. And I actually tried to do it on a regular basis. Maybe I did it like, yeah, in average 2 times a week for a period of 8 months, more or less. And after a while, I started to bring them home. I would keep them in special containers that we have for those kind of anatomic waste. And I would put them in my backpack, bring them home, and I would try to cook them. So don't think that it was huge steaks, human steaks, or, you know, it was very long, very small, sorry, small, narrow strips of flesh that I would dissect with my scalpel blade from the wound, the open wound. But I would fry it. Sometimes I would put seasonings on it. And the closer, the way I see it and the way I feed it, I would actually compare it to horse meat, because back in the days, you could actually eat horse flesh in France. That was a thing that you would find in supermarkets. So yeah, it's the closest taste that I got, that I felt when I would actually eat that kind of meat. I also had those blood bags that I was getting from the surgical unit, because I was working half time in the surgical unit, half time in the morgue, and I found a way of actually getting the blood bags that weren't used during an operation, and instead of bringing them back to the blood bank, because they had a system with stickers, I would find blank stickers and pretend that they were used, and I would keep the actual bags with me and keep them in my backpack and bring them home too. So I had those blood backpacks, those blood bags, and this flesh in my refrigerator. But all in all, it lasted about 8 months of doing this.
You were called to the hospital human resources one day, and your contract was ending, and you were offered a full-time job in the surgical block.
Yes.
But you had asked why you couldn't stay in the morgue, and they said that the activities of autopsies were slowed down by the new legislation that, yes, you know, that changed in France, and there was no longer a need for a fourth person in the office.
Exactly.
You weren't interested in this surgical block job at all, so you left. But before you left, at lunch, you say you went to visit a blacksmith.
Oh yeah.
What did you do on that? What did you do that day?
So I went to a blacksmith and I made a copy of the morgue key. The plan was to go back during the weekend, because on Sundays nobody was working there during the afternoon. So the plan was to go on a Sunday afternoon and cut the heads off the cadavers. That was the plan. And I wanted to wait until my co-workers come back on Monday morning and kill them one by one. That was the plan. So before that, I was arrested for another murder, so I could not, put that, execute the plan, but this is what I was going on in my mind at the time.
You talk about October 4th, 1994. You went to a municipal library, and you sat in front of a Minitel, again, the precursor of the Internet, which would connect you to online classified ads. So you had already been familiarized with your girlfriend Sandy being a dominatrix and using this service as well. So what did you do one day, and who did you meet?
So I contacted a person through this network on the SNM forum. And I posed as a person interested in having sex with him. So he gave me his phone number. I called him from a phone booth, making sure that there was no trace of me in that phone booth. And he gave me his address because, you know, back in the days, people did not really think about consequences, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me his address, and I prepared a backpack with my 22 caliber gun and gloves and several things. And I went to his apartment. It was on the, not the last floor, but the floor before. So, and there was no lift. So I climbed up the stairs. I don't remember which stair it was exactly, but yeah, there was 5, 6, 7, I can't remember exactly. So I climbed the stairs, knocked on the door, and he opened the door. I stepped in, and as soon as he moved towards me, I pulled out my gun and I shot him in the face. And he fell down face first. And it was a gun that's used for sports. So I had to reload the gun each time and put a bullet in the chamber each time. It was not a revolver, okay? So all in all, it took about 15 minutes for him to die. And during that that time, those 15 minutes, I shot him several times in several locations of the body. And I observed more or less how he would react each time. I can easily imagine that this really sounds awful, the way I say it, and I totally understand. But you have to understand that I was totally emotionally blank when I was doing this. It, for me, it was like experimenting and kind of like, you know, kids who are ripping the wings of a butterfly. There was no emotion. I was just observing myself doing this. I even sat down on the floor next to him and looked at what was happening, the reactions, the way he was moving on the floor, how the blood would squirt from the wounds. I didn't even see the time go. For me, it was just a matter of a few minutes. But the reports later on, the police reports and the autopsy showed that it actually took 15 minutes for him to die. So I did not have any real conscious of what was going on around, and I was not caring about me being heard by neighbors. I think that I shot 5 times in total, a total of 5 times. I even smashed his skull with a plant container. It was very long and very messy. Yes.
You write about that you sat there and observed and even went in the kitchen and got a piece of bread and chewed on it while you watched. You also found his this victim's, Bissonnière's, I mispronounced his name, but this man's wallet, and found his driver's license and a blank check.
Yeah.
What did you decide to do with the, what was your idea about using the blank check? What were you going to do with the blank check? And what about his photo that was in the driver's, was in the wallet as a driver's license? What did you do?
Well, I found the check and the wallet. It was not what I was looking for in the first place. For me, I was just, you know, doing this without thinking about stealing or buying things or, you know, getting money from this. For me, it was just about the murder. But when I found those objects, I was in such a confused state of mind that I thought that I could use that to buy myself a camcorder and film other murders. So I immediately forged the ID. I didn't even wait or, you know, try to have any second thoughts about it. But I immediately forged the ID crudely. And I went to a department store and I bought a camcorder. And of course, the person who was standing at counter, the person standing at the counter saw that it was a forged ID, so he disappeared. And I thought that it would be a bad idea for me to stay, and I left the ID in his custody. And when I went back home, the very weird thing for me was to see that they were not talking about that case, but they were talking about another case that had taken place like 3 hours right after, and it was a police shootout where three police officers were killed. And it happened 3 blocks away from where I actually committed this murder. And all the police attention was focused on that, shootout. And they were just not talking about what happened, like if it did not happen. So, of course, later on, I found out that there was, you know, articles and news, etc. It's just that I didn't saw this scene the day after. But for me, it had gone unnoticed. And as weird as it seems, I thought that I had gotten away with it. So I didn't give two thoughts about it, and I was focusing on what to do next, and that plan that I was building up about the morgue, etc. So, yeah. And 3 weeks after that, I was arrested in front of a Parisian club. They had actually found the forged ID. They had all the police stations in Paris had posters with my face on it. So it was just a matter of days until they actually found me walking the street, or, you know. So I think, I'm not sure, but I've heard things about being reported by people who knew me, but there's nothing that confirms that, and I don't want to point fingers at people, but that's what I've heard. Yeah.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talk about being arrested finally, and so now, what do your parents think about this? What do your parents do? And how does this investigation work? You talk about an investigating judge, which is unusual in American justice. So tell us a little bit about what happens once you're arrested.
So here's a little resume on how the system works in France. When you're arrested for a crime, you're in custody for like 2 or 3 days. They check the facts. They do a police search in your apartment. There's no search warrants or anything. It's a different system. But they actually search your place. They gather the evidence. And once the evidence is gathered, and if you confess, it's even easier for them. They present the case to what we call an investigating judge. This investigating judge will be the person who will be actually putting up all the investigations about your case before trial. He decides if you are placed in custody or not. So he decided yes, and I was sent to jail 2 days after being in the police station. And for 2 years and a half, he led all the necessary investigations and research. So since he was interested in knowing my psychological profile, because the debates were centered about sanity. That was the major focus of the debates, because you know, when they searched my apartment, they found all those things. And I confessed to several things. So they thought that, you know, this meant that I was probably not in my sound mind when doing this. And he launched a procedure with seven court-appointed psychologists and psychiatrists.
Right.
And the evaluation lasted for several months. So I spent 2 years and a half in prison, waiting for the trial and having all those evaluations. It really took a while. And at the end of those 2 years and a half, he had enough evidence to send me on trial. And the debates were centered on actual sanity or not. Depending on if I was found sane or insane, the sentence would change. If I was found totally insane, I would be exonerated from all charges and sent to an institute, psychiatric institute. I was found sane, but with what they call diminished capacity, I would be sent to prison, but under a lesser sentence, because this is under French law. You cannot give a normal or a sentence to a person that is proven by psychiatrists to be suffering from psychosis or diminished responsibility, what they call diminished responsibility. So
you aided those defense psychiatrists and your defense period by telling them a version of your story about and how to explain the human remains in your apartment. What did you ultimately say to them, and what was your ultimate strategy in terms of depiction of your sanity? You thought there was a better route to go with these doctors, and what was that? What did you tell them?
I knew from day one when I was arrested, if I had told them the actual motives for the murder and the fact that I was planning on doing this and that, and the fact that I was watching all those autopsy tapes for years and years about fantasizing about killing people. If I told them that I had this S&M relationship for years and years, and that I was drinking blood with my girlfriend because it sexually, you know, aroused me, I would be declared what they call a sexual sadist, all right? And for them, sexual sadism is incurable. It's
okay.
A death sentence, more or less. When you are convicted of something, you declare that you are a sexual sadist. They will never let you out. It's as simple as that, and I knew that. I instinctively that. And I also knew it from what I read about, you know, other cases involving sexual sadism. So I knew it was in my best interest to, psychologists and psychiatrists, they like to be reassured about their knowledge of things. That's the way I see it. They like
right.
a good story. And if you tell them a story of pure psychosis and paranoia and, you know, dead people talking to you, they really love that. They really love that because it reassures them. It reassures them in that their work. They find that I was what they would call a good client for them, because
right.
It confirmed all their theories about psychosis, et cetera. And I knew that by doing this, claiming all those things, claiming that I was hearing voices and this and that, that I would get what the French locals diminished capacity, which is totally different from sexual sadism, because you cannot cure sexual sadism with medication, you know?
Right.
You just can't cure it. There's no cure for this. So for me, it was really important to give them symptoms that eventually could be cured by medication.
Right.
So that it was a way out for me, you know, eventually. Because, you know, in those kind of murder cases in France, the average sentence is between 15 and 20 years. It's totally different from the U.S., of course, there's life sentences in France, but it's for extreme cases of serial murder or people who kill kids or, you know, terrorists. But for, you know, young persons like me who commit one murder, even if there's other things on the side, like, you know, those things that I did in the morgue, etc., for them, there still was hope in the future that I would be cured, according to them, and that I could no longer pose a threat to society. That's what French legislation is all about. It's not about punishment, really, per se. It's about redeeming people and, you know, finding them a place in society once they are released. So I played on that, of course, and I thought that I refocused my energy during those 2 years on, you know, studying forensic psychiatry and seeing what was the best options for me. I quickly found out that, of course, this case was extraordinary for them. And they were desperately in need for easy answers. And I gave them easy answers. I was psychotic, you know. I was not, you know. So for them, it was easy to actually find the symptoms and find something to to evaluate the case. Yeah, it was easier for them to evaluate the case and give an evaluation.
You write that on April 30th, and this is just in the midst, the trial began on May 8th. April 30th, yeah. You signed a pact with Satan. What did you write, and what did you agree to?
There was this older convict that I knew, a gypsy, and he had this weird tattoo on his arm. It was a... weird symbols, but I recognized them instantly because I had been studying black magic for a while, and they were really familiar. And there were a magical seal that is used in a grimoire, a book of black magic called the Grimorium Verum. And they are the symbols of a pact with Lucifer. And I was really, I was really surprised to see this tattoo on this guy, since it was not really his culture. And we talked about it, and he said, yeah, I was in jail for another crime a few years ago. And just before going to trial, the guy who I was sharing the cell with, who was a gypsy, who was into black magic, he tattooed me this on the arm. And he said, you will see, you will get a lesser sentence. And I got a lesser sentence. So I was really interested by this, and I decided to make a pact under the same conditions. I did not tattoo the seal on me because I did not have a tattoo gun with me, but I carved it with a blade on my bicep. And I, with the blood, I sealed the pact that I wrote to Lucifer and Satan, asking me for a good outcome for this trial. And it probably worked because I was they actually granted me diminished responsibility. And even if the prosecution was insisting on the fact that one of the cops who had interviewed me said that he was working on other similar cases. They were not sure. There was no evidence that I actually committed them, but there were still questions, and that I looked like another serial killer that he had interviewed in the 80s, and that I had the same vacant look in my eyes when I'm talking about the crime that I committed. And you know, he said all those things during the trial to make me sound like I was some kind of bloodthirsty beast. And they showed to the jury pictures of my apartment, of course. So all this really grim in the beginning. But then my lawyer, I had a very good lawyer, she insisted on the fact that I was watching all those horror movies when I was a kid, and that it influenced me, and that today's society is always showing violence on TV and in film, and she said that psychologically fragile individuals like me who could be easily confused between reality and fiction. Right. So she did this great job at outlining all those supposed influences. And the jury said that, it was a jury of seven people and two judges. And they all agreed on the fact that I had diminished responsibility. And I was sentenced to 12 years instead of the 20 years that the prosecution was asking for. So I got the 12 years, and with good behavior, I knew that I could get out after 8 years.
You talk about some of your life in prison, awaiting trial, and then once you were sentenced. What is one of the things, one of the new passions that you discover while you're in prison?
When I was in prison, I started to draw first to kill time, because it really helped to kill time. And I started to get all those letters from collectors, people who collect letters and art from criminals, because I was starting to being known as the Vampire of Paris. This is the nickname that they found me in the tabloids back in the days. Mm-hmm. And so I would get those letters from people who would collect letters from Gacy and Dahmer and all those crime personalities. And one of those collectors asked me if I was doing any paintings. And I thought that it would be a cool idea, So I started to paint. And one day I saw an ad in a tattoo magazine, and the ad was showing this picture of Charles Manson, that really famous photo from Life magazine, with this vacant stare, and I thought that it would make a great portrait. So I actually, did this portrait of Charles Manson, and for the background I used a specific red color, and it became my signature in terms of painting. People liked it. And I began to do a series of mug shots based on that very specific palette of colors. And it became my trademark as a painter. And over the years, I got more and more letters from people who wanted to get them, collect them. I was exposed in art galleries and museums, crime museums. So my reputation as a painter of those kind of mugshots grew more and more. And it was a really good outlet for me. All my negative energy was focused on that. So when I was released from prison, I kept on painting. And thanks to that, I met a lot of different persons. And I traveled a lot. I participated to art shows, TV interviews, etc. I had this second life as an artist. Of course, people were still interested in the true crime case, and they would always ask me those questions about the taste of human meat, etc., etc., etc. But, there were some people who didn't even actually know about my case who thought that my paintings were good, and this motivated me into pursuing that career as a painter. And I've been painting for more than 25 years now. I've had many celebrity clients, and I'm thankful for that, for having found that outlet in my life.
You write about that the serial killers that you read about and that you admired and respected, in certain respects, that you became part of this club while you were in prison, thanks to the media and thanks to the trial itself. Tell us a little bit about how the media portrayed you and this new found allegiance with other serial killers.
By extension, yes, I was, the people who had covered my case always mentioned the fact that I was suspected of doing more things that I did. And there was, people have a tendency to exaggerate things, so they were amplifying things. And people, they project a lot of their own fantasies when they read about crime. There's a lot of people who are convinced that Ed Kemper was a cannibal and never actually confessed to cannibalism, but there's still people who think that he's a cannibal, and it's not. It never, even John Douglas said that he never confessed to any cannibal act, but people still associate Kemper with cannibalism. It was the same for me, and they associated me with serial murder and those kind of things. So, of course, the case itself was extraordinary enough for people to get interested in the case. The fact that this nickname also helped, I guess, the media to get interested in the case, and also the fact that I had found this redemption through art without trying to deny the fact that I was still fascinated by the darker side of life, because this has been a constant in my life. I never tried to show any regret or remorse over what I did, because those feelings, I keep them for myself. I don't want it to be a public show. The only persons who are actually it's only the people close to the case who deserve to get any signs of remorse from me. But
right.
For the average persons who are not close to the case and who see this as a spectators, I don't have to tell them anything. I don't owe them anything. And I don't owe anything to anybody in that regard. I serve my time, even if people think that I didn't serve enough, and there will always be people that I deserve to spend the rest of my life behind bars. And No, that's what they think. I don't care. But the thing is, this is, has always been a constant in my life. I never give any kind of credit to people who are horrified by the fact that I show no remorse. Because as I told you, it's only the people who were impacted by that case who deserve hearing about remorse, not the general public. And this position, I understand that it infuriates most of the people who are into true crime and who mix true crime with morals. I'm going to tell you something about true crime, being myself an avid consumer of true crime. You don't watch true crime shows on TV to educate yourself. You show them, you watch them to be entertained. People don't, most people, they don't, you know, they will never admit to that. But they watch those shows to be entertained. And as being the Vampire of Paris, I've entertained lots of people with my crime. I'm not educated, I'm entertained. This is a huge difference. People do not consume true crime to become forensic psychiatrists or FBI profilers, you know what I mean?
No.
It's not an education. They consume true crime because it fascinates them. They love hearing about those crimes. It's like slowing down on the highway to watch an accident. And people will always tell me, you should not glorify those killers in your paintings. What I'm doing through my paintings, first, it's art. And art, whatever you do in art, is exempt from criticism because it's a vision, right? And second, I'm not glorifying them. I'm just showing a mirror image of what's happening in society nowadays. Netflix is showing hours and hours of documentaries on Bundy and Ramirez and all those and true crime cases from 50 years ago or 40 years ago, and people are still wanting that. And it's not because they want to know any more about the crime. Everything has been said about those crimes, but they just want to watch the footage of Bundy talking. They want to see Ramirez, the trials. They want to see those persons. They're like characters for them. They're not actual real people. See what I mean? And it's entertainment. And me as a painter, I use that reality, this fascination for true crime, and I sublimate it through art, making it more beautiful. So of course it's controversial because people are not, they don't like the fact of being reminded that they are the ones who are asking for that. They are the ones who are consuming true crime. And it's a really complex subject, but I like to steer things up. I really like to steer things up. And this is why you will never hear me in that, role as a person who says, the things I have done are wrong and don't do this, blah, blah, blah. All those things I keep private, the morality issue, because it only concerns those who were impacted by the crime.
Yes. I want to thank you so much, Nico Clo,
for coming on
and talking about The Gospel of Blood, The Crimes and Trial of the Vampire of Paris in his own words. For people that might want to take a look at this, I know this is available on Amazon, but is there a separate website where they might take a look at this book and your other work, your artwork?
Yes, I have a collector's edition that is available on a website that is called serialpleasures.com. It's my official website where I sell different products. There's plenty of different products in that website. There's also murderabilia. But if you are looking for a simple copy of the book, you can find it on Amazon. But if you want a collector's edition with my signature and the blood print, and I can do a personalized message inside the book, this is where to look for CyrilPleasures.com.
Thank you so much, Nico Klo. And for those listening as well, there is more to come with a second book to this Gospel of Blood. So I want to, again,
yes,
thank you so much for your candor.
Thank you.
And for this incredible interview, The Gospel of Blood.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Nico.
Thank you, Dan.
You have a great evening.
Thank you. Thank you, you
Good
too.
Night.
Good night.